We're number one in total and per capita municipal waste, 720 kilograms per person per year. We're number one in hazardous waste produced by a factor of more than 20 times our nearest competitor, Germany. We're number one in oil consumption. We're number one in natural gas consumption. We're number one in the least amount of tax revenue generated as a percentage of gross domestic product. We're number one in the least amount of federal and state government expenditure as a percentage of GDP. We're number one in budget deficit as a percentage of GDP. We're number one in daily per capita consumption of calories. We're number one in lowest voter turnout. We're number one in number of political parties represented in the lower or single house. We're number one in recorded rapes by a factor of almost three times our nearest competitor, Canada. We're number one in injuries and deaths from road accidents, almost twice as many as runner-up Canada. We're number one in births to mothers under the age of 20. Again, more than twice as many as Canada, and nearly twice as many as number two, New Zealand. We're number one in the number of international human rights treaties not signed. We're number one among countries in the United Nations with a legally constituted government to not ratify the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. We're number one in number of known executions of child offenders. We're number one in likelihood of children under the age of 15 to die from gunfire. We're number one in likelihood of children under the age of 15 to commit suicide with a gun. We're number one in lowest eighth grade math scores. We're number one in becoming the first society in history in which the poorest group in the population are children. Pause for a moment and reflect on that list. Doesn't it make the heart swell with a sense of pride, knowing that we as Americans, and no one else, can get to the top in so many categories? Sort of makes you nostalgic for the days when East Germany won all the medals at the Olympics. This is no easy feat to pull off, folks. Give yourselves a pat on the back and the rich another tax cut. In the interest of trying to be more empathetic toward those in the other 101 nations on Earth, I'd like to offer a few suggestions to help bring about world peace. I modestly call this Mike's Comprehensive Peace Plan. The way I look at it, we're all stuck on this island. No one gets to claim immunity, and no one's getting voted off anytime soon. So whether it's simply the right thing to do or it's because we don't want to end up with a bin Laden lurking in every airport in America, we need to help set some things right in the world. I would begin in the Middle East, Northern Ireland, the former Yugoslavia, and North Korea. The Holy Land, such a nice name, the Holy Land. For a place with more evil acts per square mile than the VIP room at Satan's annual marshmallow roast. In January of 1988, just 1 month after the beginning of the first Palestinian Intifada, a few friends and I traveled to Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza to see for ourselves what all the commotion was about. Although in my life I'd already traveled through Central America, China, Southeast Asia, and other parts of the Middle East, I wasn't ready for what I saw in the refugee camps in the occupied territories. I had never encountered such squalor, debasement, and utter misery. To force human beings to live in these conditions and to do so at the barrel of a gun for more than 40 years just made no sense. I am deeply saddened and angered by the horror and misery the Jewish citizens of this earth have had to endure. No group has consistently seen more death and torture come their way than the Jews at the hands of a bigotry that has lasted not just centuries, but millennia. What amazes me is not the nature of this hatred. After all, ethnic war seems a fact of life, but the consistency with which it has been passed down for thousands of years. Hate isn't like a grandfather clock or a gold watch. You can't leave it behind for your next of kin. If my great-great-great-grandfather hated Canadians or Presbyterians, I would have absolutely no way of knowing about it. And yet, somehow, hatred of Jews has been passed down like a language or a song or an oral tradition among so many people. Usually we humans are able to shake our bad ideas. Remember, the earth is flat? We stopped pushing that nonsense 600 years ago. We've gotten over the one about creation taking only Saturday night and the one about eggs being bad for your cholesterol. So why haven't people wised up and sent their bigotry against Jews to the same dustbin that holds our Seals and Croft records? Well, Here's one complicating factor in the case of the Palestinians. The unfortunate thing about us humans is that once abused, some of us seek to abuse others. It's no surprise that abused kids grow up to abuse their own kids. After the Americans bombed the peaceful, neutral Cambodians over and over and over, slaughtering hundreds of thousands of them during the Vietnam War, it shouldn't have been a shock when the killing fields followed and Cambodians turned the slaughter on each other. After the Soviet Union lost over 20 million citizens in World War II, it's no surprise that they sought insurance against future invasion by seizing and dominating nearly every country that bordered them. Sometimes people just go crazy from too much abuse and violence and take drastic, irrational measures to protect themselves. I don't want to involve myself in the various arguments about why Israel was created or what the historical or biblical claims are to the land. Rather, I want to deal with the situation at hand, which is the ongoing killing on both sides of the question, the continued hatred toward the Jews by the Palestinians, and the appalling oppression of the Palestinians by the Israelis. It's true that there's also much oppression of Palestinians in Arab countries, where Palestinians aren't allowed to vote or own property and are treated as second-class citizens or pawns in the fight against Israel. But I'm not going to spend my time on this, since there isn't a whole lot I can do about it. You and I don't give $3 billion a year to Syria as we do to Israel. And since that's our money, we must consider ourselves responsible for the oppression, killing, and apartheid conditions that have been created in Israel's occupied territories. The fighting in the Middle East has got to stop, and now Israel has nuclear weapons. Some Arab countries soon will, and we'd better stop this madness quickly before we all pay a huge price for it. I, for one, don't want apartheid being funded in my name anywhere. I believe, stop me if you've heard this one before, that all human beings deserve the right to self-determination. The right to the ballot, the right to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Arabs who live in the West Bank and Gaza have none of this. They are not free to travel. They are under constant curfew. They are taxed with no representation. They are arrested and jailed without trial. Their homes are bulldozed without warning. Their land is stolen and given to settlers. Their children are murdered for throwing stones or for just walking down the street. Of course they throw stones. Of course they kill Israeli settlers. That's what abused people do. They fight back and abuse others. Who should know this better than the Israelis? The world butchers them to near extinction in the last century, and they'll be damned if they're going to be annihilated in this millennium. At times like this, those of us who have been fortunate enough to avoid this kind of suffering in our own lives must step in and stop the killing. This is what I want my country to do, and here's how. Quit sending over a blank check, and start getting in there with both parties to stop the barbarism. My plan. 1. Congress should inform Israel that it has 30 days to end the bloodshed perpetrated in its, our name, or we cut off the entire $3 billion. Individual terrorism is bad enough, but state-sponsored terrorism is truly evil. I understand that the world will always have the occasional lone crazy with grievances he feels compelled to avenge with violence. But for the Israelis, a group of otherwise good and intelligent people, to collectively enforce a system of terror against another group simply because of their race or religion is unconscionable. And you and I and millions of other taxpaying Americans put up the money for Israel's unconscionable actions. Actions that could not exist if each of us wasn't having 4 cents taken from our paychecks today and every day to buy the bullets that go into the Israeli guns that kill the Palestinian children. 2. If it wants to keep receiving our tax dollars, Israel should be given a year to work out a plan with the Palestinians to create a nation called Palestine, formed from the West Bank, Gaza, and some strip of land that connects them. This new nation of Palestine must then present a constitution that not only prohibits any form of aggression against Israel, but also guarantees full democratic rights to every Palestinian man, woman, and child. 3. The United States will then give Palestine double what it has given Israel in funding. For a permanent peace, I'd gladly give up my portion of this, pennies a week. This is not free cash for corrupt public officials like the ones we have in our country. This is Marshall Plan style, direct aid that builds roads, schools, and industries that provide decent-paying jobs. 4. The United Nations should then commit to defending Israel against anyone who still wants it destroyed, and vow to defend a democratic Palestine from its neighboring Arab regimes, who are going to go bonkers if their own oppressed people see how good these Palestinian Arabs have it, living in freedom and prosperity. Of course, who's going to listen to me? Apparently it's too much fun continuing this stupid soap opera over a wedge of land you can cross in the time it takes to get from Oakland to San Francisco in rush hour. But maybe there is one person who will listen. Dear President Arafat, we've never met. That's not an attempt to cop an invite over for dinner or a game of horseshoes. You're a busy man. I'm a busy man, though I can't get anyone in the office here to call me president or respond to my directives with "Yes, sir." Sorry, that's the kind of humor that has kept me relegated to appearing only on basic cable in America, Channel 64, right after the Italian language station in New York City. I have the key to your success. I know how you can unilaterally end the killing on both sides, and as a bonus, wind up with a Palestinian state. I know you're thinking, hey, who is this guy? And you're right, but hear me out. I want to propose something so revolutionary that it will flip out every Israeli right-winger and send every Israeli peacenik running to your side. My proposal is not a new idea. It involves no armies, no money, no UN resolutions. It's dirt cheap. It has been tried many times in many countries, and it has never failed. It demands no hatred and requires no weapons. In fact, it is all about no weapons. It's called mass nonviolent civil disobedience. It worked for Martin Luther King Jr. His nonviolent movement brought an abrupt end to legal segregation in America. It worked for Gandhi. He and his fellow Indians brought the British Empire to its knees without firing a shot. It worked for Nelson Mandela. He and the African National Congress brought about an end to apartheid with no violent revolution. It worked for them. Trust me, it can work for you. Sure, you can still win through violence. The Vietnamese proved they could whip the mightiest country on earth. And look at us. We spent 8 years picking off redcoats and got ourselves a big country out of all the shooting. So killing does work, I guess. The only problem is, after the killing stops, you're a little messed in the head, and it takes a while before you learn to put down your guns. 225 years later, and we still haven't learned. But if you'd like to try the nonviolent approach, you not only get to see fewer people die, you get your own country in the end. Here's how it works. 1. Just sit your ass down. That's it. It's simple. You just lay your bodies down. Often just a few thousand in the middle of the road will do, and don't move and don't fight back when they try to drag you away. Instead of Israel always shutting down the borders to Gaza and the West Bank, you shut them down. Just march peacefully up to the checkpoint and then sit down. No Israelis will be able to get to their settlements. No Israelis will be able to transport goods and natural resources from your land into Israel. There is no Israeli vehicle I know of that can drive over mounds of thousands of people. Not even a pair of snow tires will do the job. Of course, they may try, and a number of your people may be injured or killed. Still, don't move. Just sit. The world will be watching, especially if you embrace the wonderful world of public relations and alert the media to your plans. Trust me, CNN will take your call. And you'll end up with far fewer dead Palestinians than you yield under your current plan. 2. Call a general strike. Refuse to work for the Israelis. Their economy is based on the near-slave labor you provide them. Don't do it anymore. Who will do all their shit work for them if Palestinians won't? Other Israelis? I don't think so. They need you and your willingness to break your backs for them for substandard wages. Watch how quickly a deal is struck once every single Arab refuses to go to work. Of course, they'll try to break you. They will cut off your water, your roads, your food, but you must stand firm. Stockpile. Then strike nonviolently and never give in. A few years back, over 1 million Israelis attended a Peace Now rally in Tel Aviv. That was an amazing sight. It also means that you, the Palestinians, have 1 million Jewish allies, a third of the country, in the nation you know as your enemy. 1 million of your enemies will come to your aid if you protest in a nonviolent way. Try it. Between your people and theirs, you will outnumber those in Israel who want to drive you into the sea. Unfortunately, I know your inclination is to keep drawing blood. You think this will bring you liberation. It will not. It will turn you into those who are now killing you. And if you haven't figured out one thing about the Israelis by now, you'd better get a clue. They ain't going anywhere. For God's sakes, man, they had 6 million of their people massacred by the most advanced civilization on Earth. Do you think they're going to let a few stones and car bombs get in the way of their own survival? They live in a world where they're isolated and all alone. They won't quit until you or the rest of the Earth annihilates every last one of them. Is that what you want? Every last Jew wiped from the planet? If it is, then you need serious help. And you're going to have to get past me before you touch another one of their children. But if, as I suspect, you would prefer peace and quiet to constant war and displacement, then you must lay down all arms. Lay down your bodies in the middle of the road and then just wait. Yes, the Israelis will beat many of your people. They will drag your women by the hair. They will sick dogs on you. They may even get out the fire hoses and other tricks they've learned from us Americans. You must not fight back. Trust me, when the pictures of your suffering at the hands of these brutes go out across the world, there will be such an outcry that the Israeli government will be unable to continue its oppression. Well, there you go. If you want, I will come and join you in your nonviolent protest. It's the least I can do after helping finance the bullets and bombs that have killed your people. Yours, Michael Moore. Tourist Guide to Holy Land Hotspots. Location, Tel Aviv. Historical significance. On the outskirts of modern Tel Aviv is the ancient port of Jaffa, believed to be founded in the wake of the great flood by Noah's son, Japheth, and site of the house of Simon the Tanner, traditionally believed to be where the Apostle Peter once stayed. Bloodshed. 2001. 21 young Israelis killed and more than 100 injured by a Palestinian suicide bomber outside a beachfront disco. Location. Joseph's Tomb, Nablus, Shechem. Historical significance. Christians believe the tomb is where Joseph of Arimathea placed Jesus' body after the crucifixion and where his resurrection occurred. Many Jews believe the tomb is that of Jacob's son Joseph with his technicolor dream coat. Bloodshed. 2000. Border Police Captain Yosef Madhat and Rabbi Binyamin Herling killed by Palestinians. 2000. A 2-year-old Palestinian girl riding in the back seat of her parents' car killed by bullets fired from the direction of a nearby Jewish settlement. Location. Temple Mount, Jerusalem. Historical significance. Main site of Islamic worship in Jerusalem. King David's tomb. The site of the Last Supper, etc. nearby. Bloodshed. 1990. 17 Palestinians killed by Israeli soldiers. Location. Tomb of the Patriarchs, Hebron, also known as the Mosque of Machpelah. Historical significance. Sacred site for Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Believed to be where Abraham, his wife Sarah, and their descendants Isaac and Jacob are buried. Bloodshed. 1929, Arab massacre of the Jewish community. 1994, Jewish settler Baruch Goldstein murdered 29 Muslims worshipping in the mosque. The United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Once again, the name itself gives it away. The people in charge of this one knew they were running a scam. If the United Kingdom felt it had any real moral authority to claim jurisdiction over Northern Ireland, it would simply declare it part of Great Britain and leave it at that, without drawing attention to a 6-county area across the sea that it has no business claiming. Now, don't get me wrong. I've come to like the British people. British networks and studios fund my work when the Americans won't. The Brits, if you'll allow me a sweeping generalization that can be disproved at any British soccer riot, are an intelligent people with a great sense of humor and a rabid appreciation of political satire. Unlike us, they have numerous media outlets. London alone has 11 daily papers, and their 4 national networks have more to offer on any given night than our 200-plus channels combined. The British media offer a wide spectrum of editorial viewpoints. No one is left out of the political discourse in the United Kingdom, except the Catholics of Northern Ireland. As with the Palestinian situation, I'm not going to spend time rehashing 800 years of history, so let me get right to the present conundrum. Catholics in Northern Ireland are second-class citizens whose rights are continually violated, who are kept on the lowest tier economically, and who live under the thumb of an occupational force of British soldiers. This has led to a lot of random killing in the past 33 years. Bill Clinton was able to bring the two sides together during his presidency and help work out a peace settlement that would have included Catholics in the power structure of Northern Ireland. Everyone was relieved and hopeful. But that hope didn't last long, as the Protestants soon insisted they wouldn't share power until every IRA gun was turned in. Most saw this as an excuse to try and back out of the agreement, and new bloodshed ensued. Since then, prospects have grown bleak. This nonsense has gone on long enough. I have a solution that will bring permanent peace to the area. Convert the Protestants of Northern Ireland to Catholicism. That's right. No more bickering and battling over religion when everyone belongs to the same religion. Naturally, most of the Protestants won't want to convert, but since when has that stopped the Catholic Church? From the Crusades of the Middle Ages to the Spanish conquistadors of Latin America, the Church has always known how to convince the natives to see the light. Because Catholics already make up 43% of Northern Ireland, we need to convert only 8% of the Protestants to create a Catholic majority. That ought to be a cinch, especially once the Protestants consider the following benefits of being a Roman Catholic. One guy in charge, the Pope. There are several thousand Protestant sects. Some are run by committee, some by an elected chair, others simply run like a food co-op with no one calling the shots. Going Catholic means having a leader for life, someone unafraid of making a decision, giving the faithful a fixed set of rules and boundaries that give one's life order and clarity. And after the Pope dies, no messy elections. A couple hundred guys wearing red gather in a room, vote, and a puff of white smoke out of the chimney tells everyone the decision has been made. No campaign speeches, no pandering to the electorate, no recounts. More sex. Catholics, as we all know, have more babies, and so, you know, that means only one thing, more sex. Sorry, but in the Catholic Church, you can't get the babies without the sex. And who couldn't use a little extra sex these days? I'm telling you, let those Protestant Orangemen know they're going to be getting some, and watch how fast they end those silly parades. More days off. The Catholic Church has six official holy days. In countries where the majority of citizens practice Catholicism, these are fully paid days off from work and school days off for the kids. Can you name one Protestant holy day? Not counting the day the Eddie Bauer Christmas catalog comes out? I don't think so. Free alcohol. You go to Mass every day, you get a free drink of wine. True. You must accept that you're drinking the blood of Christ, but hey, you can do that. How many times have you told people that the gin and tonic you are nursing is just water? Have a little faith. Catholic girls. Remember the above. A guaranteed spot in heaven at the right hand of God himself. It's all there in the Bible. Jesus made Peter the head of the church, and then he made it clear that only members of the one true Catholic Church get past the velvet rope at the pearly gates. So you can continue your allegiance to the Queen and then burn in hell for eternity, or you can get on the A-list and enjoy forever with a first-class seat. Once a list like the above is made available to the Protestant population of Northern Ireland, it'll only be a matter of hours before we see a mad rush toward the gates of the Falls Road, and here's the easy part. Any Catholic may perform the sacrament of baptism if one believes that the non-Catholic may die without ever being saved. I think it's safe to say that includes all of the Protestants of the United Kingdom. All you need is a little water to pour over any Protestant's forehead and then repeat the following words. I baptize thee in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen. That's it. It takes longer to join Weight Watchers. And if the Protestants seem reluctant, then Catholics can just run through Protestant neighborhoods, not with guns, but with garden hoses blessed by the parish priest. Spray the baptismal waters at them, shout the words, and then start running like hell. The former Yugoslavia. This godforsaken corner of the world has been the source of much of our collective misery for the last century. its residents' inability to get along, with Serbs fighting Croats, fighting Muslims, fighting Macedonians, fighting Albanians, fighting Kosovars, fighting Serbs, can be traced to the following single event. In 1914, a Serb anarchist by the name of Gavrilo Princip assassinated the Archduke Ferdinand. This incident kicked off World War I, which led to World War II. Over 50 million people died from both wars. I don't know what it is about these people. I mean, I don't go around killing Texans. I don't go burn down whole villages in Florida. I've learned to live with it. Why can't they? It hasn't always been this violent in Yugoslavia. After World War II, those few Yugoslavians who had fought against Hitler, mostly the Serbs, the Croats and others, welcomed the Nazis and their final solution with open arms, took over and formed a communist government under the leadership of Marshal Tito. Tito refused to answer to Moscow and set off on his own mission of uniting the ethnic factions of his country. For nearly 40 years, the people of Yugoslavia stopped killing each other. They became a civilized country. They made Yugos. Basketball became the national sport. Life was good. Then Tito died, and all hell broke loose. Croats started killing Serbs. Serbs killed Muslims in Bosnia. Serbs killed Albanians in Kosovo. Then the United States bombed Kosovo to show them killing was wrong. In the past few years, there's been peace, then war, then peace again, and now war again. It never stops. These people are addicts. And that means it's time for an intervention, not a military one, but a 12-step intervention, the kind you do with an alcoholic. I'm suggesting to the people of the former Yugoslavia that you take a pledge to wean yourselves off the violence. Set up weekly meetings in church basements all across the country, what's left of it. Sit in a circle and get it, whatever it is, off your chest. Yes, you can smoke there, and there's plenty of coffee. If you don't do this, we are going to drop thousands of those shitty little Yugo cars from cargo planes high above your country. It will never be safe to go out of the house because you'll never know when one of those 2,000-pound lemons is heading for your head. Then again, maybe science has a better solution. Perhaps this is the occasion we've been looking for, to invent a way to bring back someone from the dead. Nobody in America liked Tito much when he was alive, but now he looks like Lady Bird Johnson. If we can clone humans, shouldn't we be able to bring one back who's already been alive? I wouldn't mind seeing the United States government commit a few billion dollars to this Lazarus project. That big lug in his silly hat, taking charge of his unruly citizens once more, would be a sight for sore eyes. In the name of the millions who didn't need to die in the 20th century thanks to Yugoslavian misbehavior, we may have no other hope to restore Yugoslavian domestic peace and tranquility. Arise, Tito. 12 steps for recovery from addiction to violence in Yugoslavia. Frankly, you people haven't got time for all 12 steps. You're dying out there. Try these 3 steps and make it quick. Admit that you are powerless over your addiction to violence and that your lives have become unmanageable. Make a decision to turn your will and your lives over to the care of the United Nations, NATO, and any other organizations that stand between you and your Hatfield and McCoy-like compulsion for tribal warfare. Make direct amends to all persons you have harmed, wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others, or when they, like thousands of other Yugoslavians, are already dead. North Korea. Here's the thing about North Korea's ruler, Kim Jong-il. He's a huge movie buff with a home collection of more than 15,000 videos. Maybe he's been looking to all those movies for guidance on how to save the oppressed and starving people of his country. But since his favorite films, in addition to pornography, apparently include American Westerns, Elizabeth Taylor movies, and the Friday the 13th series, it just may be that he's looking at the wrong movies. The dictator film fan has also written a book on the art of the cinema and even founded a film school. Kim Jong-il watches every single film made in North Korea, said Kim Hae-young, a North Korean actress who defected to the South. He gives comments on acting, directing, and everything else. If he compliments some actor, he or she suddenly becomes a star.